It's business time, baby.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
My client.
Mama Monster.
Conquered the street.
We like fighting a woman.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Come over here and fight me.
Delete. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 555 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off. It is Sunday, July 15th, 2018. I am the Sala Monster. 20 years ago this week, July 13, 1998, I attended my very first Monday Night Raw at the Meadowlands in New Jersey. I won luxury box seats from the local radio station. I know I've talked about this before. I got to meet Owen Hart, Mankind, Mark Henry, and Luna Vachon. And unfortunately, half of those names are dead, which is pretty depressing, but got to meet those four. Shawn Michaels made his first appearance that night since WrestleMania 14, came out and did commentary. Undertaker nearly had his face burned off by his own pyro by one of the ring posts. Go back and watch that opening match with Vader. It's a very scary moment. Kane and Mankind won the tag team titles from the New Age Outlaws. I got to see the Brawl for All live. There's a dubious distinction. Actually, there's two of them. One, I got to see the Brawl for All live, which will never happen again. And I was also at the one and only Fatal 4 pay-per-view that there ever was. They did Fatal 4 at the Nassau Coliseum probably like, what, 8 years ago at this point? I was at that. I don't know why, but I was at that show too. And also got to see Stone Cold flip off Vince McMahon, which was pretty much every Attitude Era Raw back in 98. So, does it hold up after all these years? Does this show hold up after all these years? You can go back and listen to episode 336 of The Sound Off to find out. I reviewed that show on the podcast 4 years ago. Tonight is Extreme Rules. I'm going to run down the card, give you my predictions. There is a big wrestling show coming to Madison Square Garden, and for the very first time in almost 60 years, it is not WWE. So I'll talk about that. G1 Climax kicked off this weekend in New Japan as well. Raw scored one of its lowest ratings ever on Monday. Bret Hart is feuding with Martha Hart again. It got pretty ugly this past week. Who's right? Who's wrong? That'll be in the mailbag later. So a lot to get to, but first, you can use our Audible link to get yourself a 30-day trial of the service and one free audiobook of your choice. audibletrial.com/Sala Monster is the link to use. They've been a great partner to the podcast now for a very long time. And I know over the last few years, a lot of you have cashed in on various wrestling books and even some non-wrestling books. Now is the time to take advantage. You pop in audibletrial.com/Sala Monster. Just go through the sign-up process. You got 30 days. You could sample the service. They've got probably close by now to 200,000 different audiobook titles to choose from. And again, a lot of wrestling books on there. Justin Roberts, Daniel Bryan, The Death of WCW, which is another book I highly recommend. It's funny and depressing all at the same time. If you want to learn about so many of the stupid little things that led to the downfall of that company, it wasn't just any one thing. Use our link, audibletrial.com/Sala Monster. Could also make a PayPal donation if you'd like. The SalaMonster.com PayPal button on the right-hand side. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out. We had a lot of support this week, so I have to say thank you to John Loose Cannon Lopez, the Florida Freebird Bryant Becerra, Chuck Lunatic Lentz, Out of Control Cody Thomas, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Raymond the Mountie Medina, the Belgian Brute Nicholas Overmeer, the show-off Corey Van Dam, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, kind of a big deal Corey Blake, Killshot Keith Hart, and his niece, we'll call her adorable Amelia Struble, who is celebrating her first birthday this Tuesday. Happy birthday to her. Tony the Tiger Boylan, the Renton Road Warrior Taylor Schatt, Jimmy the Mailman Milstead, the Malaysian Mastermind Samuel T, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, the Reno Renegade, Wayne Ashanti. He and his girlfriend, Faith, let me know that their son is going on 6 months. Hopefully he's a good sleeper for that age. If you're having any trouble at all, might I suggest putting Raw on in the background. I think he'll fall fast asleep. The Anarchist, Andrew Heller. Poison Pill, Lindsay Manns. Short Fuse, Sean Simpson. The Dogs, Bollocks, Sean McLaughlin. World Famous, Dan Leopold. The Orlando Commando, Christopher Thompson. And Brandon, the Galactical Garrel. Thank you. You know why. Thank you. I saw Skyscraper last night. Let me just say this real quick. That's the new rock movie that just came out. Very much has a Die Hard vibe to it. I mean, as if you couldn't tell from the trailer and the posters. But it's no Die Hard. Not that I don't think anybody expected it to be going into it. If you did, you really need to temper your expectations with these things. It was okay. It was all right. You know, if you're just going for a cheesy, kind of stupid action movie with special effects and explosions and action, and you'll get all of that. If that's what you're looking for, just a night out, go see a movie like that. This will be the movie for you. But it really is not anything that you can't wait a couple of months to see at home, I don't think. It's built around what in the movie is, you know, in the storyline, is the new tallest building in the world. It's a 220-story skyscraper in Hong Kong. And I, you know, I was talking to a friend about this last night, and looking at this and just going, why does any building need to be that tall? See, this is the kinds of things I think about with these kind of dumber movies. That, you know, these stupid questions that most people probably don't even give a crap about. But I'm looking at this, I'm like, why does it have to be 220 stories? Who would want to work on the 220th floor of a building like that? Who would want to live on the top floor of a building like that? Like, what if you get all the way down to the bottom and you realize that you forgot your car keys? You're going to feel pretty fucking stupid going back up 220 stories. But all I know is Die Hard, Nakatomi Plaza, that was only 35 stories high. And it's one of the greatest movies ever made. So, bigger is not always better. The Emmy nominations, I wanted to mention this real quick too, because I did cover this a few weeks ago. WWE, if you remember, made for the very first time, they kind of made their pitch for your consideration. They had this whole big panel event out on the West Coast with, I think, Stephanie McMahon and Roman Reigns and like a lot of the top stars, big names were there, Braun Strowman. And they were making their pitch for their own Emmy nominations. And for the first time, WWE made the preliminary Emmy ballot. Which is an accomplishment, but again, it's only preliminary. It didn't really mean anything until the actual nominations were announced. Well, we found out this week, GLOW, the Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling, the show on Netflix, got 10 Emmy Award nominations, including Best Comedy Series, and the woman who plays Debbie, Debbie Egan, one of the main characters on the show, is up for Best Supporting Actress in a Comedy. So, wrestling cleaned up nicely in the Emmy nominations as far as GLOW is concerned. WWE, on the other hand, they got shut out. No nominations this year. I can't believe it. I'm stunned. Kevin Dunn puts over Liberty Bell. But for those of you that have never checked out GLOW before, maybe you don't have Netflix or you just haven't been interested in checking the show out, I would advise you to do so. Whether you're a wrestling fan or not, I think even non-wrestling fans, it's not like a documentary look back at the old GLOW show from the 80s. It's a dramatic scripted series that's very well done. I think the writing and the acting are great. Mark Maron, he was the guy who did podcasts from his garage. I guess he still is. But he's fantastic on this show. Before I saw him on this show, I don't know if he's done acting in any other kind of scripted shows like this before, but he's great. The other revelation on the show for me in the first two seasons, and she has more of a prominent role this season, is Awesome Kong. You know, Awesome Kong had that big monster run in TNA back in the day, and the big feud with Gail Kim, and made a name for herself was she amazing? I think in TNA she was Amazing Kong, but she came to WWE, and I still to this day don't know exactly what went wrong there. I know that there was the pregnancy that turned out to, I don't know if it turned out to not be a pregnancy or if she miscarried. I think there may have been a miscarriage, but it was a whole sordid situation there, and it just didn't work out. Her run just never, she never came back. It never panned out. She made very few appearances on TV, but in the appearances that she did make, you know, there was hope that, you know, she's going to get over as this big monster in the women's division. And I think she probably could have done very well for herself. I know she had a bad back, and maybe she still does. She was plagued by some pretty bad back problems. So even physically at that point, what kind of run would she have had in WWE? We'll never know. But I never expected her to pop up on a show like this and be as good as she is. She has been a revelation on this show. And so I just enjoy it all around. I think you would too if you've not checked out the second season. I actually thought the second season was better than the first. I really enjoyed the second season. Now they're, I won't spoil anything, but they're going to be doing I can't imagine they're not going to do a season 3. And it's a fun show. You should check it out. WWE Extreme Rules takes place tonight live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, 7 p.m. start time, as it is for all of these pay-per-views now. You can visit WrestleRumble.com, by the way, to take part in their Extreme Rules Pick'em Contest. And if you do so, you could win up to $500. I do the Pick'ems usually every month. They're a lot of fun. So that's the place to go for that. I'll just sort of mix in my Raw and SmackDown thoughts where appropriate as I go through. I'm not going to do everything separately. I'll just sort of mix them in here with the predictions. There's no sense in doing it separately at this point. There have been two matches so far announced for the kickoff show. Andrade Cien Almas against Sin Cara in a rematch from SmackDown last Tuesday. Almas won that first match. I think he's winning this one too. I really like that match from Tuesday that they had. I think that was the best Sin Cara match maybe that I've ever seen in his entire WWE run. The second Sin Cara. Actually, probably both Sin Caras. Because the first Sin Cara didn't really do much in WWE before he flamed out. But I can't think of a better Sin Cara match that I've seen in a very long time. And Almas looked good, too. They work very well together. So I think this should be a fun match. But I think Cien Almas is going over again. New Day takes on Sanity in a tables match. They had a big 10-man tag at the end of SmackDown last Tuesday. Eric Young ate the pin from Daniel Bryan. Sanity has not exactly been a big winner since coming up to the main roster. I think they need this win more. If they're going to continue this feud, maybe into SummerSlam, they need to make it interesting. And the way to make it interesting is to have the heels go over so that eventually the babyfaces can get their revenge. So I'm picking Sanity here. Matt Hardy and Bray Wyatt defend their Raw Tag Team titles against the B Team, Curtis Axel and Bo Dallas. I think the champs are retaining here. Any other outcome here would be a joke. And this paves the way, perhaps, for the Authors of Pain to attack, either after the match is over, maybe the next night on Raw, and they could stake their claim to being next in line for the tag team titles. Constable Corbin takes on Finn Balor. I gotta stop calling him that. Every time I say it, I think I almost slipped and said Constipated Corbin. Baron Corbin takes on Finn Balor. They had Corbin on Raw singing Itsy Bitsy Spider to mock Finn Balor. That is what this feud has come to. He called him Itsy Bitsy Balor. The only itsy bitsy thing here is my interest level in this match. Balor should win. He should be done with this. But it's the first match of what I'm sure will be multiple ones. So I predict Corbin wins. And really, in the long run, let's be honest here, what does it even matter? You know, Balor could lose here. He could lose the next one. If he wins at the end of the feud and then moves on to challenge for the IC title, or I was going to say the Universal title, but yeah, you kind of need a champion around to do that. It won't matter. I mean, if they're trying to get Corbin over, you know, even if you're not a Baron Corbin fan, and I am not the biggest Baron Corbin fan, you know, they have to get some new names over. I don't know if you'd consider him new. I guess he's still kind of sort of new to Raw. He hasn't really done much since coming to Raw. So if they're trying to make something happen with him, that's fine. But just not into it. Carmella defends her SmackDown Women's Championship against Asuka with James Ellsworth hanging above the ring in a shark cage. They do love the shark cage gimmick. Must have gotten a bunch of inventory back from Toys R Us. Have a lot of shark cages to sell. Plus, it just so happens to be Shark Week next week, which I'm sure the announcers will remind us of a few dozen times. Asuka had a lumberjack match with Ellsworth last Tuesday on SmackDown and won after Carmella's attempt to feed a spray bottle to Ellsworth backfired. So now he'll be locked above the ring in a cage. But that doesn't, of course, mean that he still can't funnel weapons or items down from the cage to Carmella, or otherwise just be a distraction. He's skinny enough. Maybe he can fit through the bars the way that Enzo Amore did once upon a time. Asuka loses again, I, though, predict, when Ellsworth finds a way to get involved. So I'm picking Carmella to retain here. And I think it's Becky Lynch with the feel-good comeback story taking that championship from Carmella at SummerSlam. Or at least it should be. If I'm the one sort of telling the story here, I mean, again, she's been very low-key, winning match after match after match now for a number of months, and she's been making this very quiet comeback. I say quiet because, you know, the announcers may have mentioned that she's been winning, but there hasn't really been a lot of attention or a lot of focus put on her. But it's certainly been noticeable that she's been winning a lot more than she had been. And she's still very popular. People like Becky Lynch. And I think they would get behind that story of her trying to sort of reestablish herself and be the one to take the championship from the very annoying Carmella in Brooklyn. So hopefully that's the direction they're thinking of. We have Team Hell No reunited. Kane and Daniel Bryan challenging the Bludgeon Brothers for the SmackDown Tag Team titles. I don't think they're changing the titles here, nor do I want them to. It wouldn't be a big deal if they did a title change for a big pop and then put the belts right back on Harper and Rowan on Tuesday. I don't know what purpose that would serve. But I think the Bludgeon Brothers are retaining. Daniel Bryan should be wrestling a singles match at SummerSlam. I don't care what happens with his contract. And now he did an interview with a publication just this week, basically saying he'll probably sign. He'll likely re-sign with WWE. And so we'll see how that works out. They're negotiating things at the moment. But whether he stays or goes, he needs to be in a high-profile singles match at SummerSlam. And I only pray that it's not against Kane. Because if I get my wish and the Team Hell No thing is short-lived, they could just turn around and have Kane turn on him again. And we can do Daniel Bryan against Kane at SummerSlam. And I certainly don't want to see that. I knew the mayoral election for Kane is coming up. Early next month, perhaps his return will be short-lived. You know, I just don't want to see the tired old Kane turning on Daniel Bryan. We don't need to revisit this match and this feud 4 years ago with shit. And I don't see it being any better in 2018. Bryan should be facing someone. Now, you look at the top names on SmackDown, right? And even names maybe that aren't at the tippy top of the pecking order on that show. You got AJ Styles. You've got Samoa Joe. You've got Shinsuke Nakamura. You've got The Miz. Even somebody like Cien Almas. Any one of those five. Literally any one of those five matches would be more appealing than Bryan either facing Kane or teaming with Kane. This reunion is going to have a short shelf life. We know this. There is no need to take the titles off the Bludgeon Brothers just yet. So I say Harper and Rowan retain. Dolph Ziggler defends his Intercontinental Championship against Seth Rollins in a 30-minute Iron Man match. One of the few good things about Raw last week was that Seth Rollins drew McIntyre main event, which McIntyre won thanks to Dolph getting involved. Now that's important because that gives McIntyre a win over Seth Rollins. And if Rollins regains the championship, which I think he will, I'm picking Seth Rollins to win back the IC title in this match. If Rollins regains the championship, McIntyre has a clear rationale in storyline now for being the next in line for a title shot. He beat the champion. It's like Owen Hart beating Bret at WrestleMania 10. He beat him at the beginning of the show. By the end of the night, Bret was the champion. If you're Owen Hart, you shouldn't have to win King of the Ring. You should have a clear path to that first championship match, right? Same logic applies here. But, so would Ziggler. Because if Ziggler loses tonight, they have this automatic rematch BS in this company. He's entitled to an automatic rematch for the championship. That then creates tension between Ziggler and McIntyre going into, perhaps, a triple threat match at SummerSlam. That's what I see happening. Now, the only wrinkle in all this is that we don't yet know who will be challenging Brock Lesnar for the Universal title at SummerSlam. By the way, you didn't hear all the latest reports? Brock Lesnar's going to defend his championship at SummerSlam? If only there had been somebody here to sing you a song about it a few weeks ago. Yeah, You can't see it right now, but this is my shocked face. Of course he's wrestling at SummerSlam. I've been saying that from day one. It should have been obvious to anybody. He was never not wrestling at SummerSlam. So it's likely going to be Roman Reigns or Bobby Lashley, right, challenging for the Universal title. But there is always the chance that they could make a, you know, make the call to change things up a little bit and have Seth Rollins be the one to challenge Brock Lesnar instead, in which case he would have to lose here. I don't see the point in him winning if he's going to move on and challenge for the Universal title. But then I guess, you know, how do you make sense? If this guy can't beat Dolph Ziggler and win the IC title, you know, then how do you kind of make that leap, I guess, to him challenging Brock Lesnar? But they can, look, they can find ways around that. McIntyre could screw him. They can end up having a number one contenders match on TV that Rollins wins. There's any number of ways that you could get to Rollins and Lesnar if that's the direction you wanted to go in. Unfortunately, I think that any hope of that has long faded. I think Seth wins. I think he, you know what, I think he'll win one fall to none. I think this is one of those times they're probably going to go with one fall the entire match. You know, we just saw them have a 27 or 28 minute match on TV a few weeks ago. Okay, so basically we already saw them do a 30 minute match. And, you know, it wasn't a case where they were swapping falls back and forth. So why now? Why would it end up being 5-4, right? Or 4-2 or something? I think this comes down to one deciding fall, that Rollins wins. And I think there's a very good chance we end up with that three-way match at SummerSlam. Braun Strowman gets Kevin Owens inside of a steel cage. These two have had the Tom and Jerry routine going on now for the last month or so. It's very hit or miss. Sometimes it's worked. Sometimes it has not, like the porta potty stuff. You may have laughed. I didn't. But Owens can be very funny. He can be very entertaining. So I think that we're in for more comedy here, more funny facial expressions. But in the end, Braun Strowman is the Money in the Bank holder. And he should not be losing in a comedy match. Not only should he win, and not only do I believe he will win, he's my pick to win this match, but I think that he should be the first person out on Monday night when Raw goes on the air. I think he should walk out to the ring, and I think he should walk out to announce that he is, a month in advance, pledging his intent to cash in his Money in the Bank contract at SummerSlam. Against Brock Lesnar. He needs to come out and call out Brock Lesnar. None of this chicken shit, I'll cash in when everybody is laid out, or everybody is dead tired. That's not who the Braun Strowman character is supposed to be. I mean, think about it. If anybody on that roster would call their shot and announce in advance that he's cashing in, it's Braun Strowman. And then they could end up adding Roman Reigns or Bobby Lashley. Let's be honest, Roman Reigns, and make it a triple threat. If that's what they want to do, I mean, you may not like that, but we all know Roman Reigns is very likely challenging in some way for that championship, or he's one of the people who will be challenging for that championship at SummerSlam. So then if they want to work Roman in, you know, if he either wins on this show or there's a number one contenders match between now and then, make it a triple threat, fine. But at least the fans in Brooklyn that night will have somebody to root for in that match. Alexa Bliss defends the Raw Women's title against Nia Jax. The suspended, except for house shows, Ronda Rousey will be ringside for this match. Likely will factor into the finish in some way. I predict Alexa to retain. I think most people probably would predict Alexa to retain here and then get her arm snapped at SummerSlam. Jeff Hardy defends his United States Championship against Shinsuke Nakamura, all healed up from the dog bite. Nakamura had no fewer than, I mean, I lost count, honestly, 4 or 5 chances at the WWE title, and he failed every single time. Even the matches where it was a draw, or if there was anything where he won by DQ or countout, I don't remember, but he was a failure, because he had at least 4, if not 5 opportunities at the championship, and he has still never been WWE champion. He failed to bring home the gold. If he can't win the U.S. title, okay, so now he's been knocked down a few pegs. If he can't even win the U.S. title, it may be time to reevaluate what this guy is even doing here. That plus based on all these different reports, Jeff Hardy is very beat up right now. So it just wouldn't shock me if maybe he needed some time off. The time is right, I think, to do the title change, and I'm picking Nakamura to win the U.S. Championship here. AJ Styles defends the WWE title against Rusev. Rusev was gold on commentary last Tuesday during the match between Styles and Nakamura, but there was also a moment where he got kind of serious, and he said that he's waited 4 years for this opportunity. He's never had a shot at the WWE Championship. 4 years he has waited for this opportunity. He said, I came out riding a freaking tank once. And what has he done since then? Bupkis. Nothing. But then the Rusev Day stuff, very organically on its own, just took on a life of its own and got over, and it breathed new life into a dead career. Now he's getting his first shot at the championship. I'd like to say that they're going to shock the world here, but this is the same company that put the championship on Jinder Mahal last year. I hardly think Rusev becoming champion would shock the world at this point. I think it would be fine if they wanted to give this guy a run, even if just for a month, and see how he handles it and how the crowd takes to him. But I also don't think it's time yet to take the title off AJ Styles. So yeah, I'd like to see Rusev become WWE champion, even if just for a month, and see how he does. I think that could be cool. But I'm not ready. I don't think the time is right to take the championship off AJ. After all this time, almost 400 days as champion, I think if he drops it, it's going to be at SummerSlam. But I'm fine with either one of these guys winning. I just think it's going to be AJ retaining. And then we have Roman Reigns. Very likely what will be the main event of this show. Although supposedly they're debating what match should go on last. Should it be AJ? Should it be the Iron Man match? Should it be this match? You know where my money is on. Roman Reigns against Bobby Lashley. On a show called Extreme Rules, the very likely main event of this show has no stipulation. So what is so extreme about this match? It's been an extremely boring journey to get here. The big pull-apart brawl at the beginning of Raw last Monday was probably the most interesting thing they've done with these two guys, but it's still not enough to get me interested in this match. You want to know what will get me interested in this match? If they go out there and have a great match. Lashley's work so far since he's been back has been very shaky on that front. Roman Reigns, he's had plenty of great pay-per-view matches. You can be a Roman Reigns hater and deny it all you want to, but his track record, he's gone out there and had some excellent pay-per-view main events in the past. Bobby Lashley, at least since he's come back, I can't think of one. So this is more of a test, I think, for Lashley than anything else. Now, Roman winning feels like the predictable outcome, obviously. And, you know, it also hurts Lashley. He needs this more than Roman does. What has Lashley done? What has Bobby Lashley done since coming back to the main roster? And, you know, here's their out as it relates to SummerSlam. They never did announce this, unless they do tonight, but up to this point, unless I'm completely out to lunch here, they have never announced this as a number one contenders match. They were going to do a multi-man, 5-6-man match on this pay-per-view. They did the storyline where, you know, we couldn't come to terms with Brock Lesnar. He's not going to be at SummerSlam, so the match is off. And then it just turned into a singles match. But it never turned into a number one contenders singles match. Right? So just because Lashley wins, if Lashley were to pull out the win here, does not mean that he goes on to face Brock Lesnar at SummerSlam. I mean, he'll stake his claim, I'm sure, that he should be the one. He should be the number one contender. But WWE could very easily book a rematch on Raw sometime in the next few weeks or some other kind of multi-man match on TV and make that a number one contenders match and have Roman Reigns win and go on to face Brock Lesnar. And, you know, because it has no special stipulation, they can save the no DQ stip or whatever for the rematch. But yeah, this has no stip at all. I'm picking Bobby Lashley. I think that they're going to try to shock people who think they know that Roman Reigns is going to win. And like I said, they'll use that as an out. Just because Lashley wins does not mean, oh my God, Roman Reigns is not going to be facing Brock Lesnar. No, it doesn't mean that at all. Lashley could win here, and it doesn't hurt Roman. It doesn't hurt whatever their plans are for Reigns, but at least it gives Lashley a credible win against the big name on the show. So I'm picking Lashley. So that's 11 matches. That is a full card, a very full card. That includes a 30-minute Ironman match, so it's going to be a long night, as most of these pay-per-views are, as they all now start at 7 p.m. It's going to be a long night. More so for me, because I'm going to be doing a review. You can catch that on the YouTube channel. It probably won't be up until very early Monday morning, if you want to stay up for that. Otherwise, it'll be up on the YouTube channel when you wake up the next morning. But on these pay-per-view Sundays, it's always rough, because these shows, sometimes there was a pay-per-view a few months ago, it was a Backlash maybe, that didn't end until 11:20. You know, by the time I record the review, convert everything, get it up on YouTube, I'm going to bed 2:33 in the morning, I gotta wake up at 5:30. That's not usually a fun Monday morning for me. But watch the YouTube channel, there will be a review up after the show. A few weeks ago, I talked about Ring of Honor reserving its first ever date to run Madison Square Garden sometime next year. The CEO of Sinclair Broadcast Group let it leak in a Baltimore Business Journal interview. And what followed was a very upset Joe Koff of Ring of Honor, maybe a week later, maybe, talking about MSG then backing out of that date after communication with someone, he didn't say who, from WWE. Somebody from WWE, not Vince McMahon, supposedly, reached out to MSG. There was some kind of, quote, communication, and all of a sudden MSG told Ring of Honor, oops, sorry, we can't work with you. And they were obviously, WWE was, putting pressure on them to back out, which they did. But then, a big surprise this week, the announcement that Ring of Honor is going to be running not only a show at Madison Square Garden next year, but a joint show at MSG with New Japan Pro Wrestling, being billed as ROH versus New Japan. It's a G1 supercard the night before WrestleMania at the world's most famous arena. It is now official. It is no longer a rumor. It is official. The two companies go to war. That was what the video trailer said. Tickets for Honor Club members go on sale August 8th and then August 10th for everyone else. Okada, Tanahashi, Naito, already advertised on the New Japan side. Okada getting his Rainmaker entrance, if he does the old Rainmaker entrance, at Madison Square Garden is going to be a sight to see. I say if he does it, I'll talk about New Japan in a little bit. But how this happened is a story I look forward to hearing. My guess is that once the Sinclair lawyers got involved, legally, WWE did not have a legal leg to stand on. Because if they did, if there was some sort of exclusivity agreement in writing, this show would not be happening. Whatever it was, I'm sure Vince McMahon is far from thrilled about any of this. This is the first time a non-WWE wrestling promotion is running the Garden in decades. Not even WCW was able to run MSG, and they tried, and they were shut out, but they did get to run the smaller theater at MSG instead. They couldn't even sell that out, so realistically, had WCW run the Garden itself, they probably would not have been a pretty sight. But yeah, it's almost 60 years since any other wrestling group or promotion has run a show at Madison Square Garden. The New York Post did a big story about the ROH show coming to the Garden, and the only statement they got from WWE is this: MSG is, of course, free to work with ROH however they want. A very succinct statement from WWE. Doing it the night before WrestleMania with, you know, thousands of wrestling fans descending upon New York City, it really is the best possible date they could ask for. As a fan, Friday night would have been better to avoid any conflict with the NXT TakeOver show, which is running that same night about 5 or 6 miles away at the Barclay Center. I hate that I have to choose now. I'm leaning towards the MSG show, but I'm torn because those TakeOver shows always deliver, especially WrestleMania weekend. Those TakeOver shows usually deliver more than WrestleMania does. You know, I know it's going to be a great show. Triple H, I'm sure, is going to work his ass off now to stack that card. But this MSG show, I mean, this is history. It really is. I mean, it's not really hyperbole to say that. You can say, oh, they're not going to sell out, or, you know, the card may not be as good as TakeOver, which is true. But it's still history. It's still something that I think a lot of people are going to want to be part of, at least for the first time. To see a Ring of Honor show in that building, I mean, to see a New Japan show in that building, it's history. And they're going to go all out to make that thing special. And I feel like, you know, I don't know, I kind of feel like of the two, that's the place I want to be that night. But I have a few weeks, I guess, to make up my mind. Can they sell out? Will they sell out? It depends on how many people they configure the building for. If the magic number is 15,000, and I think the capacity, I think in the current modern day MSG, I want to say the capacity is around 18,000. But then when you figure staging and everything, sometimes it's 14,000, sometimes it's 15,000. Let's say the magic number is 15, right? You've got Cody and the Young Bucks. If they can get 10,000 people in Chicago for Labor Day weekend, where there really are no other wrestling events going on, they've kind of created their own events around that with StarCast and that sort of thing. If they can get 10,000 people for that, there is no reason Ring of Honor and New Japan combined for the very first time can't get 15,000 people into Madison Square Garden. I don't know that they're going to sell it all out on day one, but they can sell that show out for sure, and they will. This show will sell out. They will pack this show. I don't have any doubt about that. And I hope it serves as a wake-up call for Vince McMahon. There is no other company out there that can come close to competing with WWE as far as revenue and the money that they generate. They're number one. Everybody else is fighting for a distant number two, okay? Nobody else even comes close. We know that. No one is delusional enough to say otherwise. Because you'll have people, you know, the WWE hardcore fans or the indie haters or whatever, yeah, these people sprout up and they go, you know, they can't sell out. No one's going to buy a ticket to see that. Everyone talking about competition and this and that. There's nobody even close to WWE. And you're right. Again, in terms of the size of the company and as big as they are and as much money as they make, you're right. There is nobody else that comes close. But that does not mean that there can't be a few healthy alternatives out there that can go out and sell out a building or sell t-shirts and Funko Pops at Hot Topic. These are the things that never would have happened even 2 or 3 years ago, but it's happening now. This is a very real thing. There's a very real hunger for something other than what Vince McMahon gives us on Mondays and Tuesdays. He has turned off a lot of people to his product in recent years. Just this one podcast alone, I can't tell you how many times I hear from people on Twitter or get an email about how I don't watch the product anymore. And they're not talking about Lucha Underground. They're not even talking about Impact necessarily. If anything, people are seem to be kind of gravitating a little bit back more towards Impact under the new regime that they have there. Or at least they're giving it a chance. But we're not talking about any of those or Ring of Honor. They're talking about WWE. These are WWE longtime diehard fans who have given up. They have given up. They listen to this show. They listen to other podcasts. They go to the websites. They'll go to the YouTube channel that WWE has to check out the odd clip here and there. And that is it. They just can't take it anymore. They cannot stomach watching Raw and even SmackDown in some cases in full every single week. This is a very real phenomenon. This is not a small little sliver of the audience. I'm not saying it's the majority either, but it's not 0.1%. There are a lot of people out there who fall into that category. I'm barely hanging on by a thread most weeks myself. I think that's why I took to Lucha Underground the way I did when that first show, when that show first premiered. I mean, it's not what it once was, I don't think, but I still enjoy it because it's different, but in a fun way. Vince McMahon historically does not take very well to other people playing in his sandbox. The idea that he won't care about this or, well, Vince doesn't pay attention to this kind of thing is complete nonsense. Of course he does. He told Chris Jericho, go ahead, do your match with Kenny Omega in New Japan. And then he did, right? Then the match with Naito. But Jericho said, and he's not even under contract to WWE right now. He's under no legal obligation or ties whatsoever to WWE, but he has said that he realizes he's walking a very fine line and that the day will come that Vince McMahon will not want him to do stuff like that. He will not want him working with New Japan anymore. It's why he did not work the G1 special at the Cow Palace, and he's not going to do All In, and I guarantee you he will not be doing the MSG show either, because those shows are not happening in Japan, they're happening here in the States. And Vince McMahon would see that as direct competition. Why do you think they tried to shut this show down the first time? He's fine with maybe putting Progress or ICW on the network, which still hasn't happened, but supposedly it will. You know, apparently, you know, he's fine with that. Or sending Hideo Itami for one night back to Pro Wrestling Noah for a show next month. Or partnering with Evolve. And a lot of these, by the way, I think are Triple H moves. But nothing happens without Vince McMahon signing off on it. So in the end, these are Vince McMahon moves, as much as they're Triple H moves. So they're partnering with these different promotions, and they're doing all of these things. But he's smart enough to know that none of those companies pose a threat to him. So, yeah, what's the big deal? Ring of Honor? Oh, hey, not so fast. We don't want you running our building. Why? What is he so afraid of? What is he so afraid of? It's a business decision. You give him an inch, they'll take a foot. I've told the story before. Vince gave Spike TV many years ago the blessing to air The Ultimate Fighter on Raw on Monday nights. They tried so many different shows. USA and Spike over the years have tried so many different shows at that 11:05 p.m. hour to try to piggyback off the Raw audience. They used to have Amit Zappa had a show, Happy Hour, I think it was called, La Femme Nikita. I mean, there's been so many, I'm like blanking out. I can't think of any others now. But The Ultimate Fighter was going to air after Raw, but not unless Vince McMahon gave the green light. And Vince said, yeah, sure, you have my blessing, go for it. And without it, UFC would be dead right now. Instead, the show was a big hit. It played a very big role in the resurgence of that company. And for all this talk about how, oh, UFC isn't competition to us, that's bullshit. Of course they are. Of course there's a huge overlap between the two audiences. Hell, UFC does pro wrestling better than pro wrestling does most of the time. If Vince McMahon knew how that show would take off and what it would mean, would he have said yes? If you can go back in time, would Vince say yes the way he did back then, if he knew then what he knows now? We'll never know. I don't think he would, but we'll never know. So I get it. You got to protect your turf, but his television shows most weeks are insufferable. Mainly on Mondays, more so Mondays than Tuesdays. Insufferable. They have their formula that works for them. They just got them two fat new TV contracts, but it's good to change up the formula every now and then. Maybe more moves like this will light a fire under his ass and get him to try harder. Now, this makes it more interesting now to see what moves Kenny Omega and the Young Bucks make heading into next year. The Bucks said in May, they did an interview saying they had 6 months left on their contracts. That would be November. They would be free to sign with another company as of this November. They've dropped little teases and hints here and there that they may be open finally to signing with WWE. But a few months ago, they also said it would be kind of dumb to sign with WWE because WWE wouldn't pay them what they would want to be paid for the schedule that they would want to be on. They can obviously afford to pay them a boatload of money. It's not a matter of, oh, WWE is, you know, like Al Bundy on that one Married with Children episode, Mr. Empty Pants. They can afford to pay as much money to whoever as they want to, if they really want somebody. The question is, would they? In light of recent events, yeah, I think they would. And you wave enough green in someone's face, and I know each of them have kids, you bet your ass the Young Bucks would sign with WWE. Plus, they can't shut up about how they want to work with the New Day, they want to try to make a match happen. They could try to, look, it was cute that they did their little video game thing at E3, and even Kofi Kingston is still going around saying, I can't believe this happened, I can't believe they didn't cancel it before it happened, this is so cool, and that's all well and good. They could talk all they want to about, maybe we can work something out and somehow figure out how to do a match. Yeah, you want to do a match? You sign with WWE. Because there ain't no other way that that's happening. So if Kenny Omega and the Young Bucks want that match so badly, I'm sorry to say, that's the only way it's ever going to happen. There is no other way that they're going to conceive of to make that match happen unless they're under contract to Vince McMahon. So they've got a lot of reasons that they might want to jump, finally, to WWE. And I suspect that the company is going to be waving a whole lot of cash at them and others over these next several months. Kenny Omega, I believe his deal with New Japan is up at the end of January. Right now, he's the IWGP champion. There is no place higher for him to go outside of WWE in terms of wrestling independently or for another promotion. To me, anyway, there's no higher level that you can be at than having that championship and being at the top in New Japan. Where the Bucks go, so too probably does Kenny Omega. You bet your ass that WWE is going to want this guy. Question is, how badly do those three want to be part of that Madison Square Garden show? How important is it to them that they be on that show? Would they be willing to sign an extension just to be on that show, even if it was only for 3 months or 6 months or a year? Will that show influence their decision to sign or not sign with New Japan or Ring of Honor? They have a good thing going right now. They're champions. They make good money, maybe great money. The way they talk, they talk like they make great money. They sell a ton of merch, and that's without WWE television exposure. They have their Being the Elite show on YouTube, which does storytelling better than WWE does. But you get to a certain point, and you get to a certain age, and when there's so much money at stake, I keep coming back to the whole money thing. It's not just about money, but when there is so much money at stake, the next time WWE comes calling, unless they lowball them, I think it's going to be very tough for them to turn that down. New Japan's 28th G1 Climax tournament kicked off this weekend with two shows in Tokyo last year. Tetsuya Naito won the G1 Climax. He went on to challenge for the IWGP title and lose to Okada at Wrestle Kingdom. And just be forewarned, there are some spoilers here. Spoilers! Spoilers incoming. Sorry. I watched the final two matches of the first night, Hiroshi Tanahashi against Minoru Suzuki. Really good match. Suzuki punished Tanahashi's bad right knee. Then came the flurry of open hand slaps and palm strikes, and even Don Callis on commentary said it was tough to watch, and it was. Then Suzuki caught him with a rear naked choke, and I love how they're still telling the story of how 9 times out of 10, if not 10 times out of 10, when Suzuki gets in the choke, locks in the choke, he lets go, and he goes for the gotch pile driver, and it almost always backfires on him. And so here, when he locked in the choke, Callis immediately said, "Keep it on, don't go for the gotch." So what does Suzuki do? He goes for the gotch. And it doesn't work. He can't get him up. Tanahashi resists. Tanahashi fights back. Hits almost an inverted dragon screw. Suzuki starts screaming and writhing in pain, which, as Rocky Romero pointed out, is something that he hasn't seen Suzuki do maybe ever in 30 years of Suzuki wrestling. He's never heard him screaming and writhing in pain like this before. And we have two high fly flows later. Tanahashi picks up 2 points and the win over Minoru Suzuki. Suzuki is like the ageless wonder. 50 years old, still going out there and having matches like this. I also watched the outdoor match he had recently with Okada. They were wrestling outdoors at a festival in honor of Suzuki's 30th anniversary in the wrestling business. And it was pouring rain. It was like a monsoon. It was a gorilla monsoon outside from start to finish. They wrestled in the rain to a 30-minute draw. They're lucky nobody broke their leg during this match. They were slipping and sliding all over the place. The Rainmaker wrestling in the rain. A lot of people pointed out the poetic nature of that. But it was a great match, and you can watch the match for free. I think it's worth it just to see these two wrestling in the rain. It's just such a unique atmosphere for a match. Even if you don't watch the full 30 minutes, which you should. But it's up right now for free on New Japan World. Even without a subscription, you can go right now and watch it. But you know, I was talking about Asuka having an intergender match last Tuesday on SmackDown with James Ellsworth. You want to watch a real intergender match with Asuka? Find the tag team match on YouTube with Asuka back when she was Kana in Japan, teaming with Mara Fuji against Minoru Suzuki. And I forget his partner's name, famous women's wrestler. Forgot her name. But it's not my thing, and it's very uncomfortable to watch, I will warn you. Asuka had the ever-loving crap beaten out of her by Suzuki at the end of that match. I mean, for an uncomfortably long extended period of time, she was just, I mean, she took a lot of abuse from this guy at the end of this match. And if I remember correctly, Asuka helped book that show. She was a booker for that promotion at the time, and she helped put this whole thing together. It was one of her last shows before leaving to come to the States, to come to WWE, and she told Suzuki to stiff her and just really lay it in. And boy, did he ever. She wanted to go out in a memorable way. Well, mission accomplished. But it is disturbing to watch. But I was talking about Suzuki here, and then I thought about Asuka in that intergender match on Tuesday, and I thought that was a walk in the park compared to what this woman went through in that match, to say the least. That is maybe the understatement of the year. The other match I watched was Jay White, Josh Barnett's least favorite wrestler in the world, taking on Okada, who came out to a remixed version of his theme song, which is fail number one. You don't remix that. That would be like Hulk Hogan coming out to a remixed version of Real American. You just don't do that. So he came out to a remixed version of his theme song. No trademark robe. Red streaks in his hair like the Japanese Red Rooster. And instead of Okada money falling, raining down from the ceiling, he walked out with balloons. Like a clown. He even hit a cross body block late in the match. And as he's flying through the air, he shouts, Scooby-Dooby-Doo. Perhaps the man has suffered one too many concussions and thinks that he's back in middle school again. I don't know. I don't get the balloon thing. But on commentary, Don Callis was trying to explain all of this by saying, now that he is no longer the IWGP champion, he was champion for 2 years. That's a lot of pressure. All those big matches that he had, all the physical punishment that he took. He's trying to explain that now that he's got that kind of that, I was going to say the monkey off his back, but the championship off his waist, he feels no pressure and he's just out there having fun. They had a really good match though. I can't say that Jay White, from the matches I've seen of his, is the most exciting wrestler in New Japan. He's not the guy that I want to see the most. Although the match he had with Juice Robinson at the Cow Palace show did win me over. This was not as good as that match was, but there was one point where he gave Okada a Saito suplex over the top rope and out to the floor. Okada hit the ring apron on the way down. That could have ended very badly, but it was done safely. I mean, as safely as you can, brace yourself for a move like that where you're really not fully in control of your body. It was just very scary to watch. The finish felt a little too American than I'm used to seeing in these G1 matches, in that White brought a chair into the ring. He shoved the referee down, right? He shoves Red Shoes down on his ass. He goes to use the chair. Okada drop kicks it back into his face. Okada picks him up. He goes for the Rainmaker. As he's sort of in mid-stride going to hit him with the lariat, White strikes the referee with a back fist. Callis is trying to explain, well, maybe it wasn't intentional, and the other announcers are having none of it. So he knocks the referee down with a back fist. Okada hits the Rainmaker. No referee. There's no referee now to count the fall. And as he picks Jay White up, White hits a low blow, followed by a chair shot, and he hits his Blade Runner finish to pick up the win. So Jay White wins. He picks up 2 points in the G1. After the match, he gets on the microphone. White does. Cuts a promo. The fans are booing him, and he just tells the fans, fuck all of you. Boy, you gotta think Roman Reigns is watching this thinking, boy, I would love to do that. If there's anybody on that roster who would love to take that microphone and basically tell the fans to fuck off, it's gotta be Roman Reigns. But can't do that. But here in New Japan, all bets are off. So Jay White tells the fans to go fuck themselves or fuck all of you. And he says that he, and not Okada, is now leading the Chaos faction that both of them happen to be a part of. So that's all I've seen so far. On the show earlier this morning, which I have not seen, and I will not, talk about the results here or anything, but two of the big matches on that show were Kota Ibushi against Zack Sabre Jr. and Kenny Omega in the main event against Naito. That one, I'm sure, is quite the match. So you can watch all of the G1 stuff, if you are so obliged. Over the next month, there's going to be a lot of G1 coming up between now and the middle of August. You can watch all of it with a New Japan World subscription. The August 11th show, which is the second to last night of the G1, is going to have Kenny Omega against Kota Ibushi in the B block of the tournament. And then the very next night, the winner of the A block will meet the winner of the B block in the finals. And the winner of that is the G1 winner for 2018. Guarantees that person a shot at the IWGP champion at Wrestle Kingdom in January. Unless Omega wins the whole thing again, because Kenny Omega is the champion and he's in the G1. That's kind of like the champion being in the Royal Rumble, which they don't do in WWE. But that's how things work in the G1 stuff. I suppose if Kenny Omega wins the entire thing again, he won't be challenging himself. At least I don't think. He did wrestle a blow-up doll once, so anything is possible. But that Omega-Ibushi match could set the stage for a rematch at Wrestle Kingdom, whether it's for the championship or not for the championship. If they know he's maybe going to be leaving and they want to get the belt off him before Wrestle Kingdom, they could do that, and they could still do Omega versus Ibushi on his way out. I don't believe his contract with them is up until the very end of January. I think it's January 31st, supposedly. So they could keep the title on him and just have him drop it at Wrestle Kingdom, but they just may not want the title to go to Ibushi. But to me, they're going to have this first match on the 11th. It could very well set the stage for a big match in January. Just a couple of quick other New Japan updates here. I talked about the Cow Palace show last week. I mentioned that Hiromu Takahashi was very seriously injured, suffered possibly a broken neck, although that's never officially been diagnosed publicly. New Japan has been very hush-hush on the nature of the injury, but he was well enough to fly back to Japan. He is undergoing treatment there, and that really is the extent to which they've given us any kind of updates, other than the fact that he will not need surgery. They said he will not need any kind of surgery, which is good, but we still don't know exactly whether or not he has a broken neck. Whatever it is, it sounds serious, and hopefully he will be able to recover fully. Jim Ross, this is something I did not mention. I neglected to mention last week because I was still going through the show. I hadn't watched the entire show yet, but on his Ross Jim Ross Report podcast, he said that the doctors, when he got back to this country, because he got hurt during that Jay White, Juice Robinson U.S. title match where Robinson was thrown backwards into the barricade. The barricade pushed into the announce table, and the announce table then pushed into Jim Ross's rib cage and knocked him down. And Josh Barnett, I mean, it looked and sounded and felt like a wrestling angle, and it turns out that it was not. I mean, maybe they're all in cahoots and they're all lying. I don't think that's the case. This was very much a real thing that happened. Josh Barnett was very pissed off when he saw JR go down. In fact, on commentary, he looked at Jay White and said, "You done fucked up, boy." Threw the headset down, went after him. Jay White was running away like a heel, which is why this all came off like a big work. The fans, once Barnett got into the ring, the fans were chanting, like, they wanted to see Josh Barnett murder this guy. And maybe in the end it turns into an angle. You know, maybe they can make money off this and they can end up doing a Jay White, Josh Barnett match at some point. Josh Barnett has fought, he's wrestled, so they could very easily do that match if they wanted to. But this was a very real thing that happened. JR was hurt. He thought maybe he had broken a rib. He came back to this country. He was in agony on the flight home. I would be in agony on the flight home just because of how long of a flight it is. But I suppose if you're flying 15 hours with a busted up ribs, yeah, you're probably not going to be feeling pretty good. But he came back. Doctors told him he has his sternum is all messed up. He's got bruised ribs and a bruised left lung. And they're very concerned that it puts him at greater risk of contracting pneumonia, which would be serious for even a younger person, let alone somebody who's almost 70 years old, like Jim Ross. He's in his late 60s, I think. Juice Robinson was on Sean Waltman's podcast. He claimed the ring crew that night told him and Jay White that those metal guardrails would be interlocked, as they're supposed to be. Obviously, they were not. As far as the ring crew, Jim Ross said the situation was inept. He said it was dangerous, and it was unnecessary. He is clearly still very pissed off about what happened. And Josh Barnett, like I said, he was legitimately hot about the entire thing. You know, he was actually on Jim Ross's podcast, Barnett was, as his guest, and he said that when the match was over, Jay White, Juice Robinson backstage. They came up to them and apologized for what happened. And Barnett said that he lectured them. I'm not sure what that means, but that don't sound good. Look, I feel bad for those guys because it doesn't sound like it was their fault in that they certainly didn't intend for anybody to get hurt. Robinson claims they were told that the barricade was going to be interlocked. But if you watch the match, it was pretty obvious that it wasn't. They should have just moved along. So, you can say on the one hand it wasn't their fault, but it kind of was. But look, mistakes happen. And hopefully JR recovers. Everything's fine. I don't think it's worth punishing anybody other than the ring crew, maybe. If you want to, you know, punish them. But I don't see this as being, you know, anything that should reflect poorly on Robinson or Jay White. Shit happens. You know, you're sitting ringside for a wrestling match, right? Shit happens. Jim Ross has been doing wrestling for, what, 35, 40 years now? He should know that better than anybody. Raw last Monday night. Twitter poll. Over 2,300 votes. 27% thumbs up. 73% thumbs down. Another week. Another bad poll. Raw Monday night set a new record. Although one they probably wish they had not set. Tying what I believe is their all-time lowest audience. I seen reports refer to it as the lowest audience of the modern era. I don't even know what that means. What does that mean? Lowest audience of the modern era. What does that mean? It was either the lowest or it wasn't. I don't know where this modern era hedging is coming from. 2.46 million viewers. The last time they did that number was September 2016. They were running opposite one of the presidential debates and an NFL game. They started out low this week, and they ended up even lower. They already got their $1 billion from NBC Universal and their $1 billion from Fox, like I said back on Sound Off 411, episode 411 of the Sound Off. They don't care what you or I think. There is no longer any incentive for them to care about fan feedback, at least when it comes to the TV shows. Now, if people stopped buying tickets and it affected the live gates, that would be a different story. But there is no other incentive for them to care. What may have hurt them this time around, besides the fact that the show largely just sucks, was all of the hoopla surrounding the Supreme Court justice pick. There were 3 different cable news opinion shows in the top 10 cable rankings this week. And yet, despite all of this, all 3 hours of Raw still occupied 3 of the top 5 spots on the top cable show rankings for Monday night. And I ask myself, how is this possible? Either Raw is much better than I'm giving it credit for, and I could see some of you listening to this going, well, actually, it is better than you're giving it credit for. Is it that much better than I'm giving it credit for? Either that, or cable TV on Monday nights is simply that bad. And upon looking at the cable top 10 for last Monday, the answer is that cable TV on Monday nights is simply terrible all the way around. Just look at this list. I pulled this list here. Number 8, MTV Florabama Shore. I don't even know what the fuck a Florabama show shore is. I was afraid to even look it up. Just the letters MTV is enough to send douche chills up my spine. MTV ain't what it was. But I looked it up anyway because I just had to know. And this show is a successor to Jersey Shore. It's like the rotten little cousin of Jersey Shore. Well, say no more. Once I read that, that told me all I needed to know. But it's set in the Florida Panhandle along the beach that stretches all the way to Alabama. And this is from a description of the show. Florabama Shore documents 8 young adults. Damn millennials. 8 young adults who live together during the summer in Panama City Beach. They are filmed partying, working, living in a new environment, and bonding. They're bonding with each other. I see. In January, MTV renewed the series for a 20-episode second season, but this was later modified to 14 episodes. It should be modified to no episodes. I guess, anyway, Monday night was the season premiere, and it came in at number 8. Garbage. Number 7, Hannity. More garbage. as most cable news is. Number 6, Street Outlaws on Discovery Channel, which is a show about street racing in Oklahoma City. I'll reserve judgment on that one. If you're a car lover, it may actually be a decent show. Number 4, Teen Mom 2, which means there was a Teen Mom 1 that did well enough to warrant a second season. In fact, quite the timing here. Just yesterday, some independent wrestling promotion in Oklahoma announced that they had come to terms with Teen Mom star Farrah Abraham to do what? They didn't say. They're going to work together. I don't know what that means. They didn't say she's going to wrestle. Maybe she's going to be on the creative team. But they're going to work together. She's going to be involved now in the wrestling business, which is great. That's fantastic. And then in the number one spot was my old friend, Love and Hip Hop Atlanta. The last time I watched Love and Hip Hop was almost 2 years ago. I didn't realize until I went back and checked it had been that long. September of 2016 is the last time I reviewed an episode of Love and Hip Hop. I watched it for the first time because Raw was so freaking terrible that I just couldn't stand it. And I was flipping around and I ended up on Love and Hip Hop. And I even reviewed it, I think, for a couple of weeks here on the podcast. Well, I look at how dull Raw has been lately, and I figured, how much worse can this show possibly be? It was number one for the night on cable. So let's take a look at what the number one show on cable TV had to offer us. I was disappointed when I tuned in. I found the episode, because they have all the episodes up on VH1.com. So I found the episode. I was very disappointed when I realized that it was a reunion show. It wasn't like a regular episode. So I say, oh, it's a reunion show, whatever. But that changed very quickly. So here's what I got out of it. Stevie J, his character on the show, he tried to recruit Erica to be the Queen of Danger Zone. But he already promised Estelita the throne. I have no idea what any of that means. Then we have Rashida and Kirk fighting to reunite their kingdom. These are the words that the host used, by the way. I'm not making this up. This is from the host. It sounds like Game of Thrones Atlanta edition here, but anyway. They fought to reunite their kingdom, despite invasions from pop-up princess Jasmine. We were 30 seconds into this show, and I'm already totally confused. All I know is that one of the cast members is a heavyset woman with long green hair and a nose ring called Tokyo Vanity. Apparently, she's a rapper. She's now dating another rapper called Ferrari. I assume he took the name of the car that he drives. If so, if I should ever start my own rap career, I shall go by the name Hyundai. But sadly, we were told that Jessica Dime could not join the cast for this reunion special, but fear not, it was only because she was at home taking care of her daughter, Blessings. Oh, how sweet. We then cut away to some footage of Kirk telling his friend, I am the father, to which the friend replies, oh shizzy. It's hard to tell if he actually said that or not because they bleeped it, but the caption on the screen said, oh shizzy, so I can only imagine that that's what he said. Then we cut to another woman. This is a completely different scene now, because remember, they're showing highlights from the season. We cut to a completely different scene of a woman in a store, and she's telling, I guess, Rashida, who's, you know, working at the store. She tells Rashida that Kirk has taken the test, and my son is your brother. Holy shit! I don't even know who any of these people are, and that sounds all kinds of fucked up. Speaking of fucked up, I fast-forwarded a little bit, and I landed on this part. This is a lady who, from what I understand, she moved out, I guess, to the West Coast. She's going to kickstart her own music career. And she worked with the gentleman that you are about to hear as her coach, her record producer, whatever position, whatever his title is. That's basically what he does, right? He's a manager, like a music manager, okay? It clearly did not work out based on the audio you're about to hear. She ended up going to work for a different manager. But this was the exchange that I landed on here. Take a listen.
I was sitting next to Mimi. She's my witness. I just asked for a Red Bull and vodka. And next thing you know, you got these bebe kids coming from the stage.
Okay,
and
let's not talk about the kids. I ain't saying nothing about your son. You know what I mean? Okay. Yeah.
I'm getting you f***ed up.
And Stevie, you guys.
Y'all heard,
ain't
right?
Enough money.
Stop. Anything happens to this man, I promise you it was me.
All right. that hoe, man.
If he calls me a hoe again, he is not leaving here in one piece. I'm telling you right now.
Ho, 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 ho. And I leave here in one piece.
Shut the
f*** up. Ho, ho, ho. Merry Christmas.
Just like your mother.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I could totally see why this show is number one. It is a 37-car pileup on I-95. You can't look away. Whereas with Raw, all you want to do is look away. But here, it's almost impossible. Now it all makes sense. By the way, Santa Claus over here got into it right after that with Sean, the other coach, the other music manager or producer or whatever the fuck. And things got so heated, he had to be escorted off the stage. They almost came to blows. They had security standing on stage between them. They had to escort him off the stage. Then the ladies started getting into it, and the host told everybody to shut up, or else she would ask them to leave. So that is your abbreviated Love and Hip Hop review for this week. I don't know what any of this has to do with hip hop. It just looks like a more well-produced version of Jerry Springer to me, but you know, there's a reason that Jerry Springer has been on the air for something like 25 or 30 years. But I am exhausted after that. I haven't heard that many beeps since my MRI. That was something else. And apparently that was only part one. That was part one of the reunion special. I guess there's a part two coming up this Monday. We'll see what happens. I don't really have much else to say about Raw this week that I didn't sort of weave into the Extreme Rules predictions. There was a tweet earlier in the week. Dash Wilder, this was before Raw even aired, tweeted Kurt Angle, you know, in kayfabe, just to tell him, you know, he and Scott Dawson, they dominated the big dog 2 weeks in a row. To which Kurt Angle responded, "So two meaningless tag team matches against two athletes that don't get along? This defines your tag team? Son, you've got a lot to learn." And people immediately pounced on Angle for basically admitting, whether kayfabe or not, that these matches on Raw are, in fact, as I've said a gazillion times on this podcast, completely meaningless. But it was something else. It was something else to see the man who plays the general manager of Monday Night Raw admit so openly on Twitter that these matches are just meaningless. And he quickly deleted the tweet. He realized, obviously, right away, oh shit, I better delete this tweet. But the internet never forgets. It's never really deleted. Kurt, come on. The old tweet and delete? That was very disappointing. Bayley and Sasha Banks. I didn't mention them before because they're not on the show tonight. Unless they're going to show more of these therapy segments, and I'm going to need therapy if they do that. But they are not on the Extreme Rules card. On Monday, it was just more therapy sessions, this time with a woman who was using Dr. Shelby's office. Bayley said that she's tired of being taken advantage of, and Sasha only cares about herself. We went from Bayley the Ripper, basically, to Bayley and Sasha talking about their feelings. Which I guess is supposed to appeal to the female audience. I mean, ladies. We have a fair number of ladies who listen to this show. Ladies, let me know if that is something that you want to see. Is that what you want to see? Is that what you really want to see? Do you want to see Bayley and Sasha seeing a therapist to hash out their feelings? Is that why you look forward to Monday Night Raw? Is that why you watch Monday Night Raw? Maybe I'm out of the loop on this. Maybe that's what women want. I don't know. I'd love to hear from those folks out there if that's what they look for when they watch this show. Otherwise, I don't know who this is supposed to appeal to. It's obvious they're just dragging this thing out. They're stalling to get to SummerSlam so they could play off the whole Bayley versus Sasha in Brooklyn thing 3 years after their big NXT match. I said that almost a week ago. I said this. I tweeted a response to somebody and I said, they're like, why are they doing this? Why are they dragging this out? And I said, it's because they're trying to get to Brooklyn. It's going to be 3 years since their NXT match. I just hope the payoff is worth it, having to sit through all of this nonsense, which leads me to this. According to Pro Wrestling Sheet, which was just acquired by Collider, so congrats to Ryan Satin, WWE is strongly considering the idea of a main roster all-women's event sometime this fall, sometime in late September or October. No word on whether or not this event may include women from NXT, women from outside the promotion, like they do with the Mae Young Classic, but that's only because the idea has not been greenlit yet. Even WWE is not sure exactly, A, if they're doing it, and B, what the format might be. But there was a very interesting move this past week that was made the TLC pay-per-view, which was set for Boston at the end of October, October 21st, I believe, was moved to December. And what had been positioned in December, which was Clash of Champions, is now apparently off the schedule. Looks like Clash of Champions, at least for now, is gone. Now, that still leaves the Australian Super Show that is going to be a pay-per-view. It's not just a network special. It will air, I believe, on traditional pay-per-view. That show is going to be taking place October 6th. Later that month, as of right now, there's an opening for that October 21st date. Instead, WWE said that it's going to be some kind of co-branded Raw SmackDown house show in Boston. But what if they move things around to accommodate that all-women show, and they do that show on that night, the 21st in Boston? And you know who would get a great hometown welcome in Boston? Sasha Banks. That could be where the blow-off happens with Bayley. Or they could build the show around crowning new women's tag team champions for the first time. And maybe by then, Sasha and Bayley have worked out their differences and they become the first ever WWE women's tag team champions, which actually is not completely accurate because they used to have tag team women's titles many years ago. But I'm sure, as WWE would say, the first women's champions of the modern era. So maybe that's the direction they go in. I don't know. Again, that's just me speculating on why they were moving dates around. But the Mae Young Classic I mentioned, that is coming up. They're doing a second Mae Young Classic at the beginning of next month. They're going to be taping. And that comes first. Before any other possible all-women show, they're doing this first. Io Shirai from the Stardom promotion in Japan, she has signed a WWE deal. She has been announced, one of the first names announced, for the Mae Young Classic. So last year it was Kairi Sane, this year it's Io Shirai. Who some say may well be the best women's wrestler in the world. It's a very big deal, her signing with this company. Caitlyn, 4 years removed from leaving WWE, she's back. And I've seen her do some interviews recently. She's looking great. We'll see how she looks in the ring. But Caitlyn is coming back for the Mae Young Classic. Ginny, the reigning Progress Women's Champion, is in the tournament. As well as Nicole Matthews. She's a 12-year veteran of out of Vancouver, she's in the tournament. And Casey Catanzaro of America Ninja Warrior fame, she had signed a while back with WWE, and she will be making her debut in the Mae Young Classic. Rhea Ripley is confirmed. She was in the tournament last year, favorite of mine. She was very impressive for her age. I think she's only 21. For her age and experience level, I thought she looked pretty good. I mean, she looks great, but in the tournament, she looked, I thought, a lot better than I expected. And even Maria Kanellis, nothing has been officially announced yet, but Maria was on Instagram teasing that even though she's a mommy now, she just had a kid not that long ago, she's teasing a return to the ring. She's about ready to make a comeback, and it might just be in the Mae Young Classic. So we've got less than half a dozen names official so far. There's going to be 32 of them, so there's going to be more announcements coming up, and we'll talk more about that as we get closer.
Hey, Sell the Monster Sounds Off podcast listeners, I'm Wade Keller from Pro Wrestling Torch. Maybe you've heard me on the Steve Austin Show on a regular basis, recapping pay-per-views. Well, now you can hear me four times per week. I do a post-Raw and post-SmackDown show called the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. We have a co-host, including, on a regular basis, Jason Solomon himself. Plus, live callers, our mailbag segment, and an on-site correspondent. And then later in the week, my podcast One Shows feature the Thursday flagship and Interview Friday. Check them out. Search Wade Keller in Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or anywhere that you listen to Pro Wrestling Podcast.
WWE has a huge photo gallery up on WWE.com right now featuring every single Performance Center recruit. And when you get to Donovan Dijak's page, he's been going by Chris Dijak in his recent appearances on NXT. He's made two, maybe three, I think, appearances in total on TV so far, including one just a few weeks ago. I think it might have been against Ricochet. He appears to have been given a new name. I'm not sure why this was necessary, but his new name, according to what I'm seeing here on the website, is Dominik Dijakovic, which is not nearly as chantable as Dijak. Maybe he chose the name himself. Maybe he didn't want to sign the rights away to the Dijak name. I don't know who's to blame for this. This may not be WWE's decision, but Dijak, in my opinion, is a far superior name to Dijakovic. But I guess it'll just take some getting used to. It was a good night for the Undisputed Era on NXT this week. Adam Cole bested Danny Burch in their match. It was non-title. Beat him with the last shot. Candice LeRae went after Shayna Baszler in the parking lot. She took exception to the comments that Shayna had made the week before about the women's division. And there was a huge pull apart between them. And they certainly seem to be teasing that maybe is the next direction for Baszler and LeRae. Or maybe they just wanted you to think that because this week coming up on NXT, there is a fatal four-way to determine a new number one contender for the NXT Women's Championship. And Candice LeRae is going to be part of that, as will Kairi Sane, Nikki Cross, and Bianca Belair. And I think maybe this was to kind of throw our scent off a little bit. Maybe they want people to think Candice is going to win. I think Kairi's going to win. I think Kairi Sane wins it, and she gets the next title shot. Johnny Gargano, Candice's other half, cornered Aleister Black as Black is trying to walk into the building. Out from the shadows comes Johnny Gargano. And he tells Black, Tommaso Ciampa cannot become the NXT champion. And Black's probably thinking to himself, you're weird, get away from me. Once he gets into the building, Ciampa attacks Aleister from behind. He gives him a draping DDT on the concrete, leaves him laying. Their championship match takes place on TV in 2 weeks. And then there was the main event. This was my favorite match all week. Kyle O'Reilly and Roderick Strong challenging Tyler Bate and Trent Seven, Mustache Mountain, for the NXT Tag Team titles. Mustache Mountain won the championships a couple of weeks back on the Royal Albert Hall UK show. And this was the rematch. This was old school tag team wrestling, and I loved it. I loved it. This entire match was built around Trent Seven's injured knee. He had a brace on the knee. They attacked the knee. They did everything they could to get this guy to tap out, to submit. He would not quit. There were dueling chants from the fans of Undisputed and Mustache Mountain. And these chants did not let up. This went on for half the match, and then it would kind of die down, and then it would start back up again. And I saw some people online complaining about it. Oh, the fans are putting... Oh, once again, they're making it all about themselves. Look, of all the stupid, idiotic chants I've heard from the crowd at Full Sail, this was not one that bothered me. They were clearly into this match. I think it enhanced the match. I think in terms of taking these people to task for dumb chants, this is not one of them. At least the chants were relevant to the match that was happening in the ring, right? So I think we could lay off the fans here for the time being. But this had Tyler Bate all fired up once he got the hot tag. He got the hot tag, crowd went nuts, Tyler Bate came in, he went wild. He's going crazy. He had a trainer was in the meantime checking on Trent Seven on the apron. So while he was attending to Trent Seven, Bate's in the ring just going crazy. There's this big show of strength where he gives Kyle O'Reilly a swing while carrying Roderick Strong on his back. Bate wanted to tag in his partner, but he saw how hurt he was. He's like, I'm not going to do it. He refused. Eventually, he got knocked backwards into his corner, and Seven tagged himself in. This is kind of that whole dumb babyface syndrome. He's on the borderline here of what I would call dumb babyface syndrome, because when you're that injured, I don't know why you would tag yourself in other than pride just takes over, right? So he tags himself in. He was a one-man wrecking crew for a while. He even hit the seven-star lariat, got a near fall out of it, but the knee eventually gave out. Kyle O'Reilly pounced. He put him in a leg lock. Tyler Bate ran in to make the save. Referee admonished him for doing so, said you better not do that again. O'Reilly locked in a heel hook. Seven still wouldn't give up. He was writhing around in agony. Then he put a knee bar on him. Bate's out on the apron. He's helpless. He can't do anything. He's not anywhere close to tagging in. He can't reach for the tag. He'd already been warned by the referee not to interfere. He grabs Trent Seven's white towel that's sitting next to him. He's threatening now to throw the towel in and call this match off. Seven looks up. He sees this. He's yelling at him, don't do it. Don't you dare do it. But he was in so much pain. The crowd was chanting for him not to do it. Finally, Tyler Bate could take no more, and he threw in the towel. And that gave the Undisputed Era the win, and they have regained their NXT Tag Team titles. I would say the last 3 or 4 minutes or so of this match was just pure poetry, but really, watch the whole thing. The entire match was just fantastic. Great action, great storytelling, great crowd. It would have hurt if they did a match like this in front of a dead crowd. They were anything but. everything just came together perfectly here. And I will say, you know, Bate and Seven were the champions. So I don't know why Tyler Bate, like if we're thinking of this in the context of, okay, why did this happen? Why did that happen? They were the champions, right? The onus was on O'Reilly and Strong to beat them. And the only way to win the titles in WWE is by pinfall or submission. So I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, you know, why was Tyler Bate so concerned about interfering again? Just because the referee warned him about it? What would have happened? He could have jumped in and kicked Kyle O'Reilly in the head instead of throwing in the towel. They would have been probably disqualified, if anything, and they would not have lost their titles. But I get it. You know, they were telling a story here with a very dramatic twist at the end, and it worked. Despite that little lapse in logic, it paid off. I cannot say enough good things about this match. Best thing all week on WWE television by a mile. Lucha Underground Season 4, Episode 5, opened with Cortez Castro in the ring and seemingly not only making his first appearance of the new season, but probably his last. Had a very short match, if you could even call it that. It was more like one move, and pinned by Matanza. Lights went out after the match. When they came back on, Castro was gone. Sacrificed to the gods. And before the match, Antonio Cueto was on the mic. He outed Castro as an undercover police officer. His cover was blown. So that would seem to end Castro here on this show. Castro's fellow undercover officer, Joey Ryan, who I guess either has not yet been exposed, or if I remember, I could have sworn maybe there was a scene last season where he was with Dario, and he kind of, he might have actually been the one to tell Dario about Castro, which is probably how his father knew about it. I don't recall, though, if they knew that Joey Ryan was a cop. I can't remember, but anyway, he was out here. He didn't seem too bothered by what just happened, his fellow partner's untimely demise. He was out next for a match with Ivelisse. He's pouring lotion down his crotch. This was for one of the ancient Aztec medallions. Ryan, you know, Joey Ryan did his usual Joey Ryan shtick. Ivelisse looked real good. Kicked out of a spine buster. She hit a big German suplex for a near fall. She hit a power bomb, and then she hit a code red for the win. Yeah, I've said before, like, I'm not big on the whole intergender stuff, but if you're going to do it, at least do it right. SmackDown gives us Asuka and Ellsworth in a comedy special. Lucha Underground gives you an actual match that serves to make Ivelisse look like a badass, right? They call her the baddest bitch in the building. That's kind of what she's called herself before, and she comes across that way. I'm not really sure what the Lumberjack match accomplished on Tuesday, other than filling time. And also, I gotta say this, you know, I was just talking about the Mae Young Classic, Caitlyn's coming back, and they're bringing in all this outside talent. Ivelisse should be in the next Mae Young Classic. The fact that she has not been given another look or another chance, as far as we know, by WWE since she was let go is ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. Now, Bill DeMott supposedly had a lot to do with her not making it the first time that she was there. I know there were stories of attitude issues and stuff, so there probably is some truth to both sides, but Bill DeMott had a lot to do with her being dispatched from WWE the first time, and according to her anyway, and he's been long gone from that company. They have 32 spots to fill in that tournament. They have a lot of names left to announce. She needs to be one of them. There is a great interview that Chris Van Vliet did with her on his YouTube channel back in May. I recommend you go check it out if you want to learn more about what she's been up to, but she needs to be doing more. And while I like her in Lucha Underground, and I'm not one of these people, everybody should go to WWE. I'm not saying that, but Lucha Underground, we don't know from one season to the next if the show is even going to be back. This was a huge layoff between season 3 and season 4. And unless you're going to indie shows where she's wrestling, you can't see her. So as somebody who's a fan of her work, yeah, I'd like to see her get more airtime by going to NXT or being part of something like the Mae Young Classic. She should be doing more. And it's a crime that she has not been given a second chance. We had the Trios Tag Team Champions, the Mac, Killshot, and Son of Havoc in a three-way dance for two more ancient Aztec medallions. The person who was pinned or submitted in this match would not get a medallion, but the other two would. So those were the rules going into this match. This was great stuff. Non-stop action, cool finish. Killshot hit Havoc with a Death Valley driver on the apron, which in case you guys don't know is the hardest part of the ring. I'm going to keep reminding you because we all know in WWE the announcers never do. Back inside, Killshot seemingly had him finished off. He hit a double foot stomp off the top, but as soon as he did so, the Mac caught Killshot with a stunner. So now Son of Havoc is down, Killshot is down, the Mac is up, and the Mac has to make a decision. Who do I pin? Because whoever I don't pin is going to get a medallion, and whoever I do pin is shit out of luck. So he decides to pin Killshot, obviously as payback for Killshot rolling him up and pinning him in the Aztec Warfare match on the very first episode of the new season. That means that Mac and Havoc each get a medallion, Killshot gets nothing. And he did not look very happy about that when the match was over. He shoved Son of Havoc away, he walked out on both of them. This does not bode well for the future of the Trios champions. Main event was Mil Muertes against Cage for another one of the medallions. Katrina was out there with Mil Muertes in her new red dress. They brawled for a little bit outside, then back inside. Mil goes for the Reaper's Trident spear. Cage leapfrogs him, though, and Muertes wipes out referee Marty Elias. So a second referee comes out, but when he only counted two for a Cage near fall, Cage gives him a lariat, which ended his night. Muertes hits the flatliner. No referee. Until referee Rick Knox comes sliding into the ring and counts 2.5. And that pissed off Mil Muertes, who chokeslams the snot out of Rick Knox. I mean, this was one of the most brutal chokeslams I've seen in a very long time. It just looked like he just slammed him down onto concrete. So now Rick Knox is out. Matt Stryker points out, we've only got three referees here in Lucha Underground. And they've all been destroyed. Cage hit a leaping cannonball dive over the top rope out onto Mil Muertes, which for a man of Cage's size is, and they have the overhead cam shoot it. It was quite the incredible sight to see. They brawl some more. They're outside the ring. Cage grabs a chair. He's about to use it. All of a sudden we see, because he's standing with his back turned, he's in the stands, so the fans are behind him. And we see one fan standing behind him pull down his hood and yanks off his mask. I mean, he had another mask on underneath, but he yanks off the mask to reveal Pentagon Dark, who hits him with a kick to the head and a sickening chair shot to the skull. This was just dead on, no hands up, boom, chair shot to the head. I don't know why they insist on still doing that. Get your fucking hand up, for crying out loud. I mean, come on already with this nonsense. Like, there's a way to do it. Look, there's a way to do it, but, like, they just stand there, and they just... This is one of those old, like, ECW, like, Bubba Ray Dudley chair shots. Like, we just don't need to see this shit anymore. Back inside, Muertes hits another flatliner, and the original referee, Marty Elias, does the dramatic crawl over and the slow three count that Earl Hebner used to do in those WWE pay-per-view main events that we don't see anymore. I kind of miss that. So Mil Muertes wins the medallion that earns him a spot in the eventual Gift of the Gods match. But after the match, Pentagon said that he would defend his championship next week against Cage. So Cage gets to bypass all of the Gift of the Gods stuff and gets a title shot anyway, which is kind of goofy, because what was the point of this? Dragon Azteca Jr., King Cuerno, Ivelisse, the Mac, Son of Havoc, and Mil Muertes are all now in possession of medallions. That's 6 of 7. So there's one more medallion left to be won. It's also worth noting that when the match was over, Mil Muertes was sort of summoning Katrina into the ring, I guess, to give him the lick of death. And she refused to get into the ring. And instead, she licked her finger, oh my, and pointed it at Mil, and I guess signaling a lick of death for him, and then she walked off. So as soon as she wins her life force back, she doesn't seem to need this guy anymore, I guess. She got what she wanted, and now she's dumping him to the side. Show ended with a skit involving Paul London and the White Rabbit Tribe. Masquerita Sagrada shows up and says, come with me. And he takes them to finally meet the White Rabbit that we've heard so much about but have never actually seen. And this guy is sitting on a throne with his back turned. He sort of spins around, and it's Killer Cross, I guess is what they're going to be calling him. He's played by Kevin Cross, who just recently made his Impact Wrestling debut. Paul London asks for his guidance, and Cross asks, well, what are you willing to do for me? And London says, anything. And Cross says, well, I want you to kill the man who brought you here. That being Masquerita, who is standing right in front of the White Rabbit tribe. He's right there. And with that, Paul London uses a giant, wooden staff to bash in the brains of poor Masquerita Sagrada. Blood splatters all over Paul London's face, all over his white suit. We don't actually see Masquerita, but there's blood just flying comically. It's like a Quentin Tarantino film, and blood is just spraying everywhere. And Cross is very pleased as the show goes off the air. So that was freaky, but I thought it was a cool way to introduce a new character. I'm curious to see what this guy is all about and what they do with him. Again, I know he just debuted in Impact. I haven't seen much of him. So I look forward to seeing what he brings to the table here. But I thought I enjoyed the show overall. My question is, how many deaths does that make so far this season? It feels like a lot of people are being killed off this season. Is that 4, 5, 6? You can count Dario, even though technically he was killed last season. But, you know, they started this season off with him in the casket and his funeral. So you can count Dario as one. Phoenix. Jeremiah Crane, I assume, since he too was stuffed into one of those caskets. Jesse Godders, right, was sacrificed to the gods, as was Cortez Castro, now poor Masquerita. They're killing off characters faster than the Raw writing team. Sad tweet of the week. We have two winners this week. The first goes to @SarahSpain. She is a reporter and a radio host for ESPN. On Wednesday, she was replying to a tweet from another sports writer who writes for the Athletic website. And this woman was asking other sports writers, what is your biggest gaffe that you've ever made during an interview with an athlete? And Sarah decided to respond, and I can only hope this exists on video somewhere. I haven't seen it, but I cringe just reading it. She said that once upon a time, she asked Ric Flair on the red carpet if he had ever taken the championship belt to bed. And she says he pointed to the woman that was with him, who happened to be carrying the title. Doesn't say what title, but she was carrying a title. And he said, she's in charge of the belt. And Sarah's response to this was to say, oh, she gets to call the shots in bed then? Turns out that woman was Rick's daughter. She didn't say if it was Charlotte or maybe because he has at least one other daughter, I believe. I imagine if it was on the red carpet, I'm sure it was Charlotte. Maybe she had the women's title with her. But it's always a good idea to do your homework before you interview someone, lest you accuse them of incest. That's a pretty sad tweet. The other winner for sad tweet goes to @WWE, who on Friday tweeted that today in history, Stephanie McMahon launched the women's revolution in WWE by introducing Becky Lynch, Charlotte, and Sasha Banks on Raw. I never knew that. Did you know that? I never knew that. I never knew that Stephanie McMahon launched the women's revolution. If that isn't a sad tweet, I don't know what is. Mailbag time. If you have questions, you can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Like Terry from Charleston, South Carolina, who actually did not include any of that information, but I did get previous emails from him where he did, so that's how I know it comes from Terry. Love your idea about dropping the Universal title altogether. Why not make the WWE Championship the main title on both shows? Have AJ Styles appear on Raw and SmackDown, then at SummerSlam he can defend it against Seth Rollins. What do you think? Perfect. The traveling champion. I like it. That's one way you can reestablish the WWE title, the top title in the company. And also, you know, it opens up so many more match possibilities with AJ. The question is, does AJ want that kind of schedule? I mean, I don't know. I don't know. I know he just turned 41. I would imagine if he was working both shows, maybe he's in a program with somebody on Raw. So he's doing Raw TV for 3-4 weeks in a row, but he could still be working SmackDown house shows, right? I don't know how they would work that, or if that's something that AJ would want, but the idea of just getting rid of the Universal title and putting more emphasis on their crown jewel, and having the quote-unquote traveling champion. At this point, it can't be any worse than what we have now. I think that would be a fine idea. Carson, in Blytheville, Arkansas. How likely do you think it is that AJ Styles breaks CM Punk's 434-day title reign? Yes, Brock Lesnar broke it with his Universal title reign, but that belt has a different lineage. Well, what'll he be at by SummerSlam would be my question, because that's where I think he's dropping it. I don't know what the number is. I think he's coming up on 400. So he probably, I mean, I could be wrong. I don't know that he'll be at 434 by the time SummerSlam rolls around. But if he breaks 434 before August 19th, then yes. Otherwise, I don't, because I think he's dropping it at SummerSlam. Kenneth from Houston, Texas. I was watching footage of Kane, starting from his debut and the first few weeks of him on Raw. Do you have an idea on how to book a monster heel like Kane in today's wrestling world, or could a monster heel gimmick even work today? Yes, it can. And I got, right off the top of my head, there's two names that spring to mind for me. Number one is Matanza Cueto on Lucha Underground, even if a lot of people aren't watching it. When Matanza was first introduced in the second season, that was maybe the best introduction of a monster heel since Kane debuted in 97. That's how good it was. That's how strong they kept him for a while. Now, not so much, but although they're starting to really book him like a monster again now. But yeah, Matanza, I think, is a great example of how to book a monster heel in today's wrestling. And the other name I would give you is Braun Strowman. I know he's a babyface now, but you know, before the fans basically turned him babyface, he was booked as the monster. I mean, it's part of his stupid nickname that they gave him. Oh, the monster among men. Yeah, they booked him like a monster, and guess what? The guy got over. Now, he got over because he put the work in and because he wasn't completely terrible when he would wrestle like so many of these other, you know, big guys are. But they took to him because, in large part, he was booked in a very strong way. He's trying to murder people, these big feats of strength. They kept him strong. They didn't beat him very often. Wow, what a concept. Somebody actually got over by protecting them and booking them, like the monster they are. And now Strowman is one of the top stars in the entire company. So those are the two best examples, I think, modern day that I can give you. The answer is yes, it can be done. It doesn't happen very often. And really, you can only have so many quote-unquote monsters, you know, because if you have five different monsters, each of them don't feel as special. So somebody like Strowman, when he was first tearing shit up and first getting over, I don't know that it would have worked as well if you had two other people like him on that roster. You may have had Kane still around or Big Show or something, but I don't, how many people still look at those guys as real monsters, right? I mean, Kane goes away and comes back and gets the big reaction and, you know, maybe he does something heinous every now and then, sets someone on fire or something, but you can't have too many of them. And Strowman is proof positive that WWE, when they want to, they know how to book a monster. Alex from Detroit, I was wondering if you knew why Enzo and Big Cass were beefing so hard. I would think with all the indie promotions that would want those guys, they would hook back up and make tons of money together. They have not been on speaking terms since the night after SummerSlam last year. They had a street fight on Raw the next night in Brooklyn. That was the match where Cass tore his ACL and could not finish the match. Enzo did a podcast interview a few months ago. He said that he resented that. He talked about, you know, Triple H when he tore his quad. He finished the match. And how he being Enzo, he had been beaten up and made to look like a fool for months and months by Big Cass on TV. And this was going to be his big moment where he took, I think, the steel chair it was, and he was going to hit Cass with it. I don't even think Enzo was going to win the match, but he just resented the fact that Cass could not at least take a big chair shot from him. He just sort of, you know, in Enzo's eyes, he just gave up. He quit. And that offended Enzo. And it's possible that there's more to it than just that. Maybe there was some simmering bad blood between them even before that. But Enzo is on record as having pointed to that as being the reason that they have not spoken. It's been almost a year. I think if there were a promoter out there who offered enough money, the two of them would absolutely work together again, either as partners or as opponents. I don't doubt for a second. If they got a big money offer, money talks. Believe you me, the two of them would come together very quickly. But the whole notion that, you know, Cass, you got hurt, you should have finished the match. I'm not a wrestler. I'm looking at this from an outside perspective here. I just think it's completely foolish. I mean, look, I respect the hell out of anybody who gets hurt, like seriously hurt, and just feels, I got to put on a good show for the fans. I got to put the effort in and just finish what I started. Or if there's like 5 minutes left in what was a 20 or 30 minute match, I get it, right? You want to just see it through to the end. And I respect the hell out of them for that. But I'm also of the opinion that if you suffer an injury like a torn ACL, you know, and Cass is a big guy, if he tears his ACL, he was trying to finish the match. If I remember, he was going for that Empire elbow. He bounced off the ropes. He went to go jump and he just crumpled in a heap on the mat. And then the trainer came over, and WWE now is a lot more strict than they were. That didn't happen in 2001. Believe me, in 2001, there was no trainer coming to the ring or a doctor sitting at ringside who was going to tell Triple H, oh, you're done. You know, you're done. It's like Daniel Bryan when he had the concussion issues and he had that match on TV with Randy Orton on Raw, and they called it off, and he was furious. He went backstage. He almost got in a fist fight with Triple H. He's cursing and yelling at him. They had to be pulled apart. He couldn't believe that they called that match off and didn't let him finish because he's very old school and he feels, I've got to finish what I started. It's just a different company now. It's a different world. That wouldn't have happened 15, 20 years ago. But how smart is it if you're a guy like Big Cass who's trying and then you collapse on the ground, your ACL is gone, and you're going to hold it over the guy's head, why didn't you finish the match? To me, that just sounds stupid. That's just Enzo being selfish. I mean, he's got every right to be upset, but it's not like Cass, you know, asked for that to happen. I'm going to tear my ACL on purpose so I don't have to do the job to Enzo Amore. Or even if he wasn't doing the job, I'm going to intentionally land on my knee and tear my ACL out and put myself on the shelf for 9 months and have surgery and grueling rehab just so I can get out of Enzo hitting me with a chair. You know what I mean? Like, it just sounds idiotic. It's not like that's what he was, you know, hoping to have happen. The guy, he blew out his ACL, for God's sake. That's a serious injury. I'm not going to sit here as a fan and be like, oh, he should have finished the match. I'm like, shit, if that were me, I'd be in the fetal position on the ground crying. So that's my take on it. But anyway, that's the root of the issues between them. And like I said, it's been almost a year and they haven't even spoken. And Dan from Gary, Indiana. What do you think of the back and forth this week between Bret Hart and Martha Hart over, as Bret puts it, her erasing of Owen's memory from wrestling? First of all, Owen's memory will never be erased from wrestling, so let's just put that to bed right now. I think the whole thing is incredibly sad. Bret has made a lot of negative comments about Martha over the years, going back at least to the time that she filed a lawsuit against WWE. For that Hart Family DVD that they put out and their use of Owen's name and his likeness in it. They settled that lawsuit a few years after that. I don't recall if the terms were ever publicly disclosed. I don't believe so. But at the time, Bret said that he did not speak to Martha anymore. And he hadn't even seen Owen's kids, his own nephews, in over a decade. And that probably was almost a decade ago now. That, to me, is the saddest part about this entire thing. As close as Bret and Owen seem to be, because you could be brother or sister with somebody but not be terribly close. As you get older, you each grow apart, you move away, you each have your own family, but they seem to be fairly close. And the idea that Bret hasn't even communicated with or seen his own nephews in, I mean, at this point, it could be 15 years or more, is so sad to me. And in this latest interview that he did, Bret went off on her again. Bret went off on a lot of things, but he's very upset that Owen is not in the WWE Hall of Fame. He called Martha a very obtuse, square-headed person, which is an odd insult to hurl at someone, but there it is. I just have this image in my head of Martha Hart now as a Lego. But he said he's done more to, or she rather, has done more to erase Owen's memory than she ever did to remember him. That's a strong thing to say to someone's widow. Now, Martha, who we don't hear from very often, released a statement through the Owen Hart Foundation, which she established back in 2000, almost 20 years. And I saw so many comments this week from fans saying, I had no idea that there even was an Owen Hart Foundation. I had no idea that something like that even existed. I did. I'll admit I completely forgot about it, but I do recall many, many years ago hearing that she was establishing that. But yeah, it's not something that gets a lot of publicity, unfortunately. If it did, maybe more people would support it as sort of a way to, you know, show their appreciation for Owen. I think she probably needs to be doing more to get the word out there about this foundation. But anyway, let me just read a little bit here. This is from Martha's own words from the statement that she put out. She said, "The suggestion by Bret Hart that I am erasing the memory of my late husband Owen Hart is reckless, irresponsible, and clearly untrue. Bret's comments are rooted in the fact that I have steadfastly refused to work with the WWE to exploit Owen's image for commercial gain. Owen was an incredible entertainer, and I know his many fans around the world enjoyed his wrestling career immensely. I encourage them to continue to do so. But I am firm in my belief that the WWE was responsible for Owen's death. As a result, I cannot and will not support any efforts by them to profit off of Owen's memory. Instead, I, my son Oj, and daughter Athena have worked tirelessly to honor Owen through the good works of the Owen Hart Foundation, which has exceeded $4 million in gift-giving and contributions towards scholarships, homeowner bursaries, and other special projects that have greatly improved the lives of so many in Canada and around the world. We have always believed that this is the most fitting public tribute to a man of profound integrity, a wonderful human being who just so happened to wrestle. I know that Owen would be very proud of the tremendous accomplishments of the foundation. Bret Hart's comments are disrespectful and cruel. It is disappointing that so many in the media have chosen to report them without seeking my perspective. Whatever Bret may believe, the fact is that far from erasing Owen and his memory, I have devoted the last 20 years to celebrating his life in a very public way. I can think of very few people who have been remembered so glowingly by their spouse." Yeah, that last part came off a little self-serving there at the end, but here's the problem. Here's the problem. They both have valid points. They both have valid points. It is not fair to attack either side too hard, because you're dealing with family members of somebody who passed away, and the way in which he died is so just, it was so appallingly preventable. It's like when you hear about a drunk driving death. I've used this as an example of things before, where you'll have an innocent person sitting in their car get rammed by a drunk driver who had no business being behind the wheel, and, you know, 8 or 9 times out of 10, how does that story end? The innocent person in the other vehicle is dead, and the drunk driver, they live. And not only do they live, they usually walk away without a scratch on them or without any kind of major injury. And I hear stories like that, or I read this other story the other day of animal abuse. It was just, there are stories that you read that make you angry, right? There are things, horrible things that happen that really just are appalling, and you ask yourself, why? Why would something like that happen to a good person like that? And I kind of felt that way after Owen died. So many people came out, so many tributes, not one negative thing I heard from any of the people that ever worked with him saying anything negative about Owen. They would talk about his ribs and practical jokes and stuff, but, you know, I don't recall ever hearing an Owen Hart rib story, and Bret loves to tell them. I don't really recall ever hearing about one that I think came off as just really malicious or mean-spirited. Like, there are classic wrestler rib stories that are just disturbing. You know, even someone like Mr. Perfect, who would cut people's clothing up, or the British Bulldogs, things they would do to people's personal property. There's no fucking place for that. Like, I'm sorry. Like, a practical joke is one thing, but when you just destroy people's property and call it a joke, like, you know, if that were me, yeah, I wouldn't take that too kindly either. But you never really heard stories like that about Owen. And then the way he died, just appallingly preventable. That never should have happened. If that were my brother, or if it were my wife, I would be angry too, and I would be resentful just the way that she is. All of the above. From Martha's point of view, she doesn't want WWE making money or profiting off of her husband, and she holds the company responsible for his death. Is that fair? Yes and no. You can blame the company that made the harness that broke for his death, but it was still a WWE stunt. They contracted with that company. It was their idea. She doesn't want them making money off of him. In her eyes, the Hall of Fame is a vehicle for them to make money, and in that respect, she is absolutely 100% right. The WWE Hall of Fame is a marketing tool. It is a marketing tool for the company. If they could not sell tickets and they could not make money off of it, they never would have brought it back in 2004. It would have been dead and buried after 96. 8 years between Hall of Fame inductions. Why? Because they finally figured out a way to make money off all of it. Because they're a business. So I can see Martha's point of view on that. She takes a very cynical point of view on a lot of these things, but she's not wrong. But I could also see Brett's point of view. I'm sure that he would love to give the speech inducting his brother into the Hall of Fame, or you know, to see a whole new generation of fans exposed to Owen Hart, who otherwise probably wouldn't know who he is. Because I don't think he's in any of the video games or anything like that. I would have to think not. I'm sure Martha would not approve of that. So he's left out of a lot of these things. And yeah, you're going to have a lot of people who don't know who Owen Hart is. Brett sees Martha as the obstacle to that happening. When they made a Hart Family DVD and had photos of Owen in there, she sued them. Brett knows that all that does is scare WWE off from doing anything involving Owen Hart, and he resents that. In his mind, it's like Owen never existed. And he blames her for that. He cannot understand why she would want to do that to him. So I get it. There is no easy answer here. I was thinking like the best thing to do would be for WWE to pledge either a big donation to the Owen Hart Foundation, or if they wanted to induct him into the Hall of Fame, come up with some kind of a solution where proceeds from the sale of an Owen Hart Hall of Fame shirt or something would go to the foundation. But that's never going to work. Because in Martha's eyes, just by selling tickets to the Hall of Fame, they're making money off of it. Because they fill these big arenas up with 10 or 15,000 people every year for the Hall of Fame. They're not little quaint banquets and hotel ballrooms anymore like they used to be, and maybe frankly they should be. They're an arena show. They're no different than Raw or SmackDown or NXT. Instead of a ring, you have a stage. It's all the same. So that solution would not work. It would not be acceptable to her because they're still selling tickets and they're still making money off of it. WWE is not going to give all of the money that they make that year in Hall of Fame ticket sales to the Owen Hart Foundation. Right? Now you're getting into an argument about, well, how do you determine the number of tickets that Owen's induction sells? How much is an Owen Hart induction really worth? It's impossible. That just doesn't work. So she's never going to agree to it. As long as there's breath in her body. I look, it's been 20 years or something now. You never say never, right? Even Brett came back after Montreal, but in this case, this is different. This woman doesn't care about wrestling. She's got no emotional attachment. Bret Hart, eventually, he was watching a match on TV and said, man, I'm getting the itch. I want to come back. You think Martha Hart is sitting there watching WrestleMania or watching Monday Night Raw thinking, boy, I sure would love to do some work with WWE. Hey, there's Dana Warrior on stage doing the Warrior Award. Boy, I sure would love to do that. She doesn't care. I get the sense that she never liked wrestling to begin with, even when Owen was doing it. So she's got no emotional attachment. She is not going to change her mind. Martha cannot dictate whether or not WWE honors her husband. If they wanted to put him in the Hall of Fame, they could put him in next year. But this right here, everything I'm talking about, this back and forth that happened this week and her putting a statement out, this is a great illustration of why WWE will not do it. Look at the shitstorm this one little back and forth created. It became a big story. Now magnify that by 20 if WWE ever went ahead against her will and inducted her husband into the Hall of Fame without her blessing. The headaches that she would cause for them, it would be a PR nightmare. There's just no easy answer here. I would love to sit here and say, just put him in the Hall of Fame. Extend an invitation to the family to attend, even if you know they won't, but extend the invitation anyway. Let his brother do the induction and make a very public, very large donation in good faith to the Owen Hart Foundation. But remember, She sued them the last time they made money off his name, and we still don't know the nature of the settlement. What we do know is that she claimed at the time that WWE was not paying royalties that were due to them, and that they were breaching a contract that was like limited use of his name or likeness or something. As ridiculous as that sounds, because it's the man's real name. It's not like it was some made up phony stage name. There are apparently legally restrictions on the ways in which WWE can use his name and likeness, and that makes Bret very angry, and he has every right to be. But hurling insult at the mother of his nephews and calling his widow names like that, it's not going to fix things. I'm more interested in how you find there's a ton of Owen Hart footage right now on the WWE Network, which people pay a subscription fee to watch. And yet she doesn't seem to have an issue with that. Is that not profiting off of her husband's name? If so, why hasn't she sued WWE for that? Is it because they are paying her royalties right now to her family, and so she's okay with that? I don't know. That's why I'm asking. This whole thing is a mess, and it shouldn't be. Owen Hart should be alive right now, and he's not, and that sucks. And you know what also sucks? The fact that his family feud, this family feud here that's been going on for years and years, is still going on almost 20 years after his death. You think this is what he would want? People calling his brother bitter and calling his wife all sorts of horrible names that I won't repeat here? It's depressing to see. Keep sending in those mailbag questions, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter, @solemonster. I'll be live tweeting during the Extreme Rules pay-per-view, so come join me and tweet along during the show. Don't forget the Extreme Rules review will be up exclusively on YouTube sometime after the show is over. And I will be back for a brand new podcast next weekend. That will be episode 556. So until then, have yourselves a great week. I will see you back here next weekend. Until then, be well, stay safe, and enjoy, for those of you tuning in, Extreme Rules tonight. I will see you on the YouTube channel later on. Take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solemonster sounds off.
They have Kane in the back. This is what he said. Tonight, I will delight as I enter the abyss with a fellow monster. But it is I who will climb out alone and with a smile across my face. Oh my God. What do they think this is, Shakespeare? I was driving yesterday, and some asshole double parks his car in the service lane. I should have cut a promo the way the WWE would script one out for me. Why art thou parking like one's smelly orifice? I wish 1,000 deaths upon thee. Then I could do a fucking tope and we could fade to commercial.
Since 2007, The Solemonster Sounds Off. Available at thesolemonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solo Monsters Sound Off.